Hello, this is Robert Stark. I am joined here with Robert Lindsay. Robert, great having you on.
Yes, thank you very much, Robert.
So we're going to be discussing the situation with Turkey attacking Russia and this whole situation in the Middle East. But on the topic of the Middle East, I was actually looking over I have this thing on my website that shows you where your hit counts are arriving from, Robert. Do you get that on your site?
Yes.
I just got a hit count from Baghdad in Iraq looking up my Max Hardcore archive.
Oh, okay.
I have no idea what it is. Maybe ISIS is getting their depravity from American porn.
Well, those Arab countries look at a lot of porn, you know.
Well, I have fans like all over the world. I get a lot of different hit counts from different places.
Right.
So basically, what happened is Turkey attacked Russia. They attacked a Russian plane. It happened in Syria, but relatively close to the Syrian border. Mm-hmm. And I gotta say Russia has actually shown a tremendous amount of constraint. Look, the United States attacked so many countries that have never even threatened us, like Iraq. And the question is, was Turkey doing this purely on its own, or did someone else put them up to it?
I agree with Lavrov. Lavrov says it was a planned provocation. I think it was. But you never know. I don't think they could have done this without NATO permission.
And there is something, and I'm not sure if you're familiar with, it's called NATO Charter 5, and it says that if a NATO member is attacked, then all of NATO is obligated to come to its defense.
That's Article 5.
Yeah, that's right. So Russia obviously is going to be very cautious in how it deals with this. As I said, the Russians have shown a tremendous amount of constraint. I personally wouldn't blame them for retaliating.
They're already retaliating. They bombed places in Syria that are like, there's trucks back and forth.
There's a tribe called the Turkomen. They're like a Turkish tribe, and they're in Syria, but they're supportive of the... They're basically like allied with like ISIS, basically.
Well, that area where the plane went down is controlled by al-Nusra, which is al-Qaeda. However, there are a bunch of other groups in there, and one of the groups is this armed Turkmen group that is supported very heavily by Turkey and also by the CIA. It's that group that Russia was bombing the other day. Is armed by the CIA, is armed by the United States. And they fight side by side with al-Nusra, which is al-Qaeda.
Are they, do they have direct ties to ISIS as well?
No, not that I'm aware of, no. But that area is not ISIS controlled, it's Nusra controlled. But
al-Nusra is basically al-Qaeda, so that you're saying al-Nusra is not... They're not officially allied with ISIS, but they're de facto allies in the sense they're both fighting to take down the Assad regime.
Well, sure. Everybody's fighting to take down Assad, of course. But Nusra and ISIS, I don't think they like each other all that much.
Is al-Nusra, so they're supported by Turkey, the CIA, I think Israel, and Saudi Arabia and Qatar.
The U.S. is not directly arming Nusra. we are still arming our moderate rebel friends. These Turkmen that were getting bombed, those are supposedly some sort of moderate rebels. Our weapons only go to moderate rebels. However, what I heard is that 90% of our weapons that go to these moderate rebels end up with, you know, ISIS and Nusra and just radical groups like that.
So, yeah, I think they're not officially allies, but they're definitely working together. There's a lot of overlap between those groups.
Between which groups?
ISIS and al-Nusra.
No, not at all. They're not working together at all. ISIS is not working with anybody.
So ISIS is more controlling the eastern part of Syria, closer to Iraq, and al-Nusra. I think al-Nusra, they control the area near the Turkish border, and they control the area near the Golan Heights, near the Israeli border.
Yeah, they're around Homs, too. They're kind of all over the place, too. There's the main group in the country is called the Army of Conquest, and all it is al-Nusra and RR al-Sham, and that's it. And those are the two main groups, and those are the ones that it's centered around. And there's a bunch of Free Syrian Army groups or whatever they're called associated with them. But that group, the Army of Conquest, is the one that conquered a whole bunch of territory recently. And they're getting a lot of guns. I guess you could say the U.S. is arming al-Qaeda and al-Nusra because al-Nusra is being armed by Turkey, Qatar, and Saudi Arabia.
Both ISIS and al-Nusra, they're both Wahhabis.
Yes, I don't know who's arming ISIS. I understand that ISIS supplies all come from Turkey. The weaponry comes from Turkey. So Turkey is definitely supporting ISIS. And I heard that even now Qatar is still supporting ISIS. Saudi Arabia is not officially supporting ISIS anymore, although maybe they were several months ago. I don't know that Saudi Arabia is directly arming ISIS at the moment. But, for instance, a whole bunch of ISIS fighters were airlifted out of ISIS territory by Saudi Arabia and the UAE, and they're flown down to Yemen to start fighting down there in Yemen. So just even several months ago, Saudi Arabia and UAE were supporting ISIS. You know, they were moving them around from place to place to start wars and fights.
You have this post, so do we really want a preemptive world war with Russia by F. William Engdahl? And
yes.
This is about the United States. And so there are U.S. politicians like Marco Rubio who are actually, and also Carly Fiorina, they've actually advocated like war with Russia.
Right. Is that what they've done?
Yeah.
Oh, well, yeah, see, they're crazy. They're trying to out-craze each other. Basically,
I think out of all the Republicans running, Donald Trump is the most sensible on this. He actually said we should just leave Russia alone and let Putin deal with ISIS. I think he's the most sensible.
Right, right. I agree, but I don't like him for a lot of other reasons. I think he's a fascist. You know, the left starts calling him a fascist right away. The cultural left started calling him a fascist and the professional left, and I don't really like those people very much, and they call everybody a fascist. They call me a fascist. But as I observed Trump more and more, especially the violence that his goons have been engaging in lately, and he wants to bring back torture and mass surveillance, the police state, and, you know, Trump is a fascist. Right-wing populism is fascism, generally speaking, everywhere and always. That's what it tends to be. That's why I don't like right-wing populism very much.
But you don't have a problem. You basically, you're not, the cultural left would call him a fascist for his stance on immigration, trade, and H1Bs. But you, I mean, you're not calling him a fascist for that. You're calling him a fascist because of things like torture and mass surveillance.
Mass surveillance. And did you see what his goons did at one of his rallies recently?
What happened?
Well, there was some guy heckling him, and I don't know. He got surrounded by Trump supporters, and they beat the living hell out of him. And Trump was asked later on, and he said that guy got what he deserved. So he has goons going around beating people up now, and that's fascism. Sorry.
So,
oh, he's really attacking communism. He's calling Sanders a communist, and fascists always attack communists. First thing that they attack. They call people communists.
So back to the topic of Russia. Yeah, I mean, the United States has been, I don't think that, and obviously the United States is not going to go to war with Russia because both countries have nukes, but they use sort of these like proxies wars going on. And that's also the reason like ISIS is able to be successful, is they exist in a power vacuum because these different countries are having proxy wars with each other.
Right. Well, this is a proxy war. It's Afghanistan all over again.
And also, I know people have been saying that Yemen is Saudi Arabia. They said it could be Saudi Arabia's Vietnam.
That wouldn't surprise me at all. The Yemenis, nobody could ever defeat the Yemenis. It's still going to be the Afghans.
The Yemenis are very much a very strong kind of warrior culture. The Saudis have a lot of expensive aircraft that they bought from the United States, but they're very kind of, their own soldiers are very pathetic and cowardly.
Yemenis are like the Afghans, right? Tribal warlike culture, and terrain is very forbidding, and it's hard to get around, and nobody ever defeats the Yemenis. It's just a quagmire. Whoever tries to defeat them just gets drawn into a quagmire. It's like the Afghans.
Is this the first time that Saudi Arabia has been dragged into a major war? Usually the Saudis like to fund proxies, but they've traditionally tended to avoid direct conflict. But they're basically the prime sponsor of terrorism.
Saudis, yes, they are. They are what's behind terrorism all over the world. Well, ISIS was originally a Saudi project, you know. I mean, you understand that, right? ISIS has been a Saudi project from the very start. And it's basically Prince Bandar's baby. You know, Prince Bandar, he's buddy-buddy with all U.S. presidents and former U.S. presidents and all, and he's the guy who was running ISIS.
And I noticed you posted a while back in your blog that you said all the nastiest countries in the world are U.S. allies.
That's a bit of an exaggeration.
Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Pakistan, even Turkey's gotten pretty nasty, and they're a close U.S. ally.
Right, Israel. If you're an awful country, you're probably a U.S. ally. Colombia.
So Russia did not violate Turkish airspace. What happened is Turkey artificially moved its border, and this was an article by the Syrian Free Press. But I just want to point out their blatant hypocrisy. Turkey has constantly violated Greek airspace for a very long time.
Yes, they violated Greek airspace 244 times just last year.
And Russia has been very cautious about not violating Turkish airspace, but I don't think they have at all. I mean,
it even one time. They probably just came within 5 miles of the border, because if you come within 5 miles of the border, Turkey says you're in Turkey and you're violating our airspace. I mean, Turkey has basically claimed hundreds of square miles of Syria and is calling it Turkey.
So they would probably have to fly over Iran, which is a Russian ally, and then from there they would have to go over Iraq, which I'm not sure. The government of Iraq is Shia, so they're allied with Iran. So I'm not sure where they would stand on Russian planes, but that's probably the route they take.
The Iraqi government is very much pro-Russian. They want the Russians in there. If they're getting mad at the U.S., the Iraqi government claims that the U.S. is supplying ISIS with guns. Iraqi legislators complain about that all the time. Iraqi tribes on the ground complain about it every day. And Iraqi parliament opened an investigative commission to look into allegations that the U.S. is airdropping weapons to ISIS. So, I mean, there's an awful lot of people saying that the U.S. is arming ISIS, especially over there in Anbar. I mean, it sounds completely insane. Why would we arm ISIS? But there's a lot of people accusing them of that, and the Iraqis are supposedly our allies. I don't get it. You know?
Well, there's a famous story where there was this Humvee of ISIS Toyotas going from Iraq to Syria, and the U.S. military had a plan, had the chance to obliterate them completely, but they did nothing. But I think what it is because the Iraqi government, which came into power, is mostly Shia, and they're an ally of Iran. So the U.S. strategy has been to weaken the whole sort of Iranian Shia sphere of influence.
Yeah, I'm not sure why we would be supporting ISIS in Iraq. I think we wouldn't fight him at first because we were trying to get that Maliki guy thrown out because we didn't like him. You see, we are mad at the Iraqi government because they would not give us permanent basing rights. You see, we want rights to have permanent force of U.S. troops within Iraq, and that Iraqi Shia government said, no way, you don't get permanent basing rights in our country. You cannot have permanent troops in our country. And the U.S. was supposedly furious about that. And this, the way we got back at Maliki was we didn't do anything about ISIS.
And another thing to point out that's mentioned in this article is that the U.S., France, Britain, Jordan are regularly, and also Israel, they regularly violate Syrian airspace as well.
Yeah, sure. Yes. I don't know about the British so much. Definitely the French, the U.S. I don't know about the Jordanians. It's the U.S. mostly is violating Syrian airspace. We don't have Syrian government permission to be running around bombing ISIS. We need Syrian government permission to be doing that. Syrian government could shoot down our planes right now, completely legally, because we have no basis under international law. Under international law, we're like invaders, and we can be shot down at any time. And there's nothing wrong with it.
Yeah, that's the thing. Is like the U.S. government and media propaganda was saying that Russia was doing this illegitimate. They got permission by the Assad regime, which is the legitimate government of Syria.
Right. What Russia is doing is actually completely legal. They were invited in by the government of Syria, and they have Syrian government approval to be doing whatever they're doing in Syria. So their presence there is completely legal and above board, and our presence there is completely illegitimate and illegal.
I want to talk about the situation in Turkey and their Prime Minister Erdogan. Can you talk about his what your take on his agenda? Basically, my take on him is he sort of has this neo-Ottoman agenda where he wants to – basically, he's a Turkish imperialist.
Yes, yes, bring back the Turkish – the Ottoman Empire. And also he's kind of a pan-Turkic guy. There's a mentality called pan-Turkicism or pan-Turanianism, And it's a really toxic type of Turkish ultranationalism. And it basically says that everybody who speaks a Turkic language is a Turk. And that they want like one great big huge country stretching all over Asia that is like the nation of the Turks. And he claims those Turkmen people in Syria are Turks, and they really aren't. They're Turkmen, and they don't really speak Turkish either. Well, they do speak Turkish, but they speak a pretty divergent dialect of it. He has settled a number of Uyghurs. Erdogan brought in a whole bunch of Uyghurs from China, from Xinjiang in the far west of China, and he settled them inside Syria in villages that were abandoned due to war. And he brought them in with their fighters. The Uyghur fighters came in their radical Islamists, and they went to fight alongside al-Qaeda. They joined al-Nusra, and he brought their families in too, and then he's settling their families all over in these villages in Syria. So basically, I think he wants to annex part of Syria and just make it part of Turkey.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. And that would also bring in China into that conflict, because I know that's also with straining. China could get involved with this, because China is an ally of Russia, and there has been Chinese ships patrolling the coast of Syria as well. But
yes.
I know it's actually really strained Chinese-Saudi relations, because ISIS is spreading to the Uyghurs in China.
Yes, the Chinese want to get involved in this whole thing because they see these ISIS guys as coming after them next. You see, the Chinese and the Russians think that ISIS is basically a U.S. proxy, a U.S. tool. And we kind of use these guys, we kind of shuttle these ISIS guys around the world, ISIS or whatever, the radical Islamists, and we use them to attack our enemies. We basically use them in Libya to take down the Libyan government. We're using them in Syria now to try to take down the Syrian government. We use them in Afghanistan to take down that government there. We have a history. There are allegations we supported the radical Chechen fighting in Russia over there. So there are allegations that we've been supporting these fundamentalists, and we're sort of supporting the fundamentalists in Yemen also.
You have the Yemeni government. Then you have al-Qaeda, and then you have these Houthis rebels who are Shias, who are allies of Iran.
Yeah, well, the government, I don't know, it's illegit. The government was overthrown by the Houthis. So I guess the Houthis are the legitimate government now. Under international law, I guess you could have armed revolutions under international law, I guess. In an armed revolution, the rebels just come in and overthrow the government, and they're the new government. And I guess apparently that's legitimate. So the Houthis are probably legitimate government. I mean, there was a revolutionary war and they won. So, and the Houthis, they're seen as a tool of Iran, but they aren't really. They're just these Yemeni populace. That's all they are. And they have a lot of legitimate beefs against that Hadi regime. Hadi is a Shia. The regime that got toppled is the leader's a Shia. And not only that, but he's a Houthi. The guy who got toppled, I think he's a Houthi himself.
Oh, so you're saying that a new puppet regime that was Saudi-controlled was put in, and the Houthis reacted in response to that?
Yeah, this guy was like a Saudi puppet regime, but he himself was like a Shia, and I think he's even a Houthi. So it's not really Shia versus Sunni. It's more like, you know, the Saudi puppet government got overthrown by these Houthis, this Houthi army, and they don't really like the Saudis very much. They're not.
I know when the Khobar Tower bombings happened, the Saudis blamed Hezbollah on that. But a lot of people think it was actually Al-Qaeda.
No, I don't agree that Hezbollah was involved in that at all. However, I think Iran might have done it. The group that was blamed was called Saudi Hezbollah, and that's basically supported by Iran.
And they've been totally annihilated. The only existing Hezbollah is the Lebanese one. But it's interesting about Saudi Arabia is their oil fields are – the Shia population is concentrated in the Saudi oil fields. So if they
right.
broke away and succeeded, that would totally shut down Saudi Arabia.
Well, they certainly cannot allow secession of those areas. And I would support the Saudis if they were fighting against rebels that were secession. You can't just have rebels go and break off the most valuable part of your country just because they want money. I mean, I don't agree with that. That doesn't count for self-determination, sorry.
I see what you're saying, but I mean Saudi Arabia is one of the nastiest countries that there is. I mean...
Yeah, I mean, I hate the Saudis, but I would support them against Shia secessionists. But there are no Shia secessionists. The Shia are just completely downtrodden there, and they're treated like second-class citizens. And the official government religion just totally hates them. And that's what their beef is, that they're treated like crap.
Back to the issue of Turkey. So I think you mentioned this article in the beginning of the interview, but there's an article by Stephen Lendman, and it says Turkey did not act on its own. Was Washington complicit in downing Russia's aircraft? So does he have, actual explicit evidence that the U.S. and NATO was involved in taking down the aircraft, or is he just speculating?
Everybody who's saying that is simply speculating. We have no good, hard evidence that NATO was involved in that this at all.
And basically, yeah, that NATO Charter number 5 basically gives Turkey a free pass to do whatever it wants without retaliation.
Well, sort of, but Turkey has to false part of Turkey. Turkey has to invoke the Charter, the article. Turkey has to invoke Article 5, and Turkey has not invoked Article 5. But nobody wants to attack Turkey as a country because Turkey can always invoke Article 5.
And Turkey has actually been a long time adversary of Russia going back. I mean, Turkey and Russia, they fought the Crimean War in the 1800s, and then they were enemies in World War I.
Well, yeah, those are two sort of imperialist countries. They both have had imperialist ambitions on the region there in the Near East, and they were two expansionist countries who were in conflict with each other. The Turks were expanding mostly to the northeast, and the Russians were expanding mostly to the south, and they kind of bumped heads into each other.
So was
sort
that
of a part of something they used to call? They used to call it the Great Game, back in the 1800s. The British were involved in it, and a bunch of other countries. It sort of centered around Afghanistan. It's just like what's going on now. Geopolitics is a dirty game. Nobody seems to realize this, but geopolitics is a dirty game. Nobody has clean hands. Everybody's just kind of playing chess. And they're very smart people, and you got to be very, very careful what you do in geopolitics. I mean, you screw up, you make one false move, and man, your country's just annihilated. You got to be really smart. And everybody who's involved in this geopolitics is very crafty, and you got to be careful about what you say too. You got to be careful about every sentence and every word that you say. It's got to be thought out very carefully. But I don't understand how you can do geopolitics at all unless you're a psychopath.
Yeah, I mean,
everybody
absolutely.
Who's involved in geopolitics is a psychopath. I think John Kerry's a psychopath, or sociopath. I think Hillary Clinton is a sociopath. Putin may be one. Erdogan is definitely one. I mean, you have to be a psychopath or sociopath to run the CIA.
You have this post, the U.S. endgame in Syria, and basically,
yes.
I mean, you touched on this earlier, but it says the U.S. strategy is, well, is not necessarily to allow Islamists to take power, but is to sort of break up Syria and just to weaken it so it's not, it's just an unstable country. But they do really want to get topple Assad as their main goal. So
yeah.
If a failed state results, there would no longer be a chain of Iranian-influenced Shia crescent that includes Iran, Iraq, Syria, and Hezbollah.
Right.
And
right.
Then basically Hezbollah would no longer be – and Israel wants to get rid of Hezbollah. And
right.
Hezbollah is fighting ISIS. And then – the other goal would be to create a U.S. puppet regime in Syria. That's their goal, but that might be difficult to pull off. And then the other issue is there's a gas pipeline that
right.
is planned from Qatar to Turkey and then into Europe.
Yes, yes. And that's probably what this whole war is all about. It might be about that pipeline. You see, they want to put that pipeline through, and there's an alternative pipeline that goes like from Iran to Europe. Through Saudi Arabia, through Eastern Turkey, Eastern Syria also, and they were all set to go with this pipeline, and they thought Syria was going to approve, and then Assad said, get out of here, I'm not approve of this. And then soon afterwards, Qatar and these Gulf countries and Turkey, they were soon after that, they were supplying these rebels with all kinds of guns. So it almost looks like the conflict over the pipeline is what set off the war. It's probably true. I mean, people find it very hard to believe, but actually most wars are over economics, you know. All those poor guys getting slaughtered, it's just all about money. All wars are bankers' wars.
The thing is, like, Syria has oil and gas, not to the degree of Iraq, but they do have a significant number of oil, and that's definitely
yeah.
a factor. And Libya, that was definitely a factor. That was a major factor in Libya because at one point Libya was the wealthiest country in Africa because of their oil.
Yes, and not only that, but Gaddafi was demanding some reasonable concessions from those oil companies that were operating there. He wanted them to split a lot of their profits with the Libyan government, which is perfectly national. You know, if you're in a foreign country and you're extracting their resources, you should share some of the profits of that with share some of the money you're making off of that with the government. And the agreements are often 50-50. It's often 50% ownership. But the oil companies got very mad. They're very mad at Gaddafi because he was not going to Libya. The oil companies just want to go in there and take all the oil and not give the country a nickel. No, but Gaddafi said, "Hey, no way. He's a nationalist." You know, he said, "Hey, no way, no way. You're taking this is our patrimony. This is our natural resources, and you got to repatriate."
Yeah, kind of like. What happened in Iran when Mossadegh nationalized the oil and they instituted a coup in there, the CIA?
Right, yeah, and after that, and also he was a threat to the dollar. He was threatening to go off the dollar. And the dollar is the world's reserve currency, and supposedly a lot of our economy is propped up on that basis. And every country that has decided it's going to drop the dollar has gotten attacked. Iraq said it's going to drop the dollar, and it got attacked. Libya said it was going to drop the dollar and substitute some sort of African money, and it got attacked. Iran said we're going to drop the dollar, and we're basically targeting Iran. So if you say you're going to drop the dollar, you're probably going to get attacked by the United States.
You have this The Dirty War in Syria, The Basics by Professor Tim Anderson. And basically this goes over a lot of the points that we've been saying, but I'll just read this. Washington and its allies in Syria, they use this guise of a fake revolution, using basically Islamic gangs to take over a country. And I also have to say that the Assad regime actually showed a tremendous amount of a constraint as well. Basically, what happened, these rebels were doing, there were some protests in Syria, but the rebels, they started, like, blowing up police stations and kidnapping Syrian military officers and police officers and torturing them. And Assad actually showed more constraint towards them at first than, like, the U.S. or Israel would have.
Yeah, probably. And those initial protests that were supposedly put down with guns by the Syrian government that supposedly started this whole Syrian revolution, the whole line is fake. There were protests in Daraa, which is a city in the south of Syria, down near Jordan and Israel. I don't know what they're protesting about, something. And maybe they had a legitimate beast, but there was a large crowd had gathered for protests. Shots rang out into the crowd. And everybody, the whole media and the whole West, and probably Wikipedia, says that the Syrian government opened fire on the crowd. That's not true. It's just like in Ukraine. They had these fake snipers. They're fake snipers. The snipers were the Muslim Brotherhood. They're Muslim Brotherhood people, and they were up in a mosque. Minaret of a mosque or something. They're firing from a mosque, and they fired on both the Saudi police and the demonstrators, just like in the Ukraine. The Saudi police didn't even have any guns at that demonstration. They didn't even have any guns. They just had riot gear. And a whole bunch of Saudi police got killed. Why would Saudi police open fire on themselves? The whole thing that set off the revolution was a provocation by the Muslim Brotherhood, and a lot of people are saying it was NATO. A lot of people are saying NATO put those, was behind those snipers, those Muslim Brotherhood snipers.
I also remember there was that propaganda that Assad was gassing civilians.
Yeah, and he didn't even do that. He didn't do it. Everybody still thinks he did that to this very day, the Ghouta massacre or whatever. But there wasn't even one person who died of sarin gas poisoning in that attack. There was some sarin released in that area, but it's all very confusing. It doesn't really make sense. The people had some very low levels of sarin in their bodies, but it wouldn't be nearly enough to kill you or even make you sick. You know, I mean, you think that sarin stuff is poison, but you need a significant amount of it in your body before you even get sick, and you need even more before you die. And if you just get a little bit of it, nothing's going to happen. And the sarin levels in those people who supposedly died of sarin, they're all just extremely low. But somehow, some sarin gas was released, but it was released by al-Nusra and Turkey. The whole thing was that was a false flag. It was done by al-Nusra and Turkey, and the purpose was to try to drag the world and NATO and the U.S. into the war on the side of the rebels. And one thing it did accomplish was...
Basically, Turkey's objection is they want to provoke a major war. Basically, it could end up... I mean, who knows? It could end up being World War III, but they want to provoke a war where Turkey drags all of Europe and the United States into a war... In Syria, and basically, then they could basically expand and have, like, their greater Turkey.
Yeah, right. I think Turkey is trying to drag NATO into it right now. But that Ghouta attack, the sarin that was found, they analyzed that sarin, and Syrian government only has one kind of sarin. It's some kind of industrial sarin, and it's the kind that they make, and that's all they got. This sarin that was used in that attack was not Syrian government sarin. And this is the British MI5 MI5, it was just their CIA that determined that. And the British MI5 said the Syrian government did not do this attack. Somebody else did. The sarin that was found in the people's bodies was sort of like a bathtub sarin. You know, just this kind of junky stuff that you make in your bathtub. But
there was
before
also
that,
there was also that ISIS attack in Turkey against the Kurds, against a Kurdish protest. And
right.
It turns out that there were Turkish police complicit in that.
It looks like the government was completely complicit in it. You mean the one in Ankara?
Yeah, that one.
Well, yeah, usually these rallies have a large police presence. And mysteriously, at this rally, for some reason, there was no police. The police just kind of vanished at this rally. They weren't even there. And then this explosion goes off, and a bunch of people get killed and hurt. And then the ambulances start coming, and the police cars block the ambulances and stop them from getting there. There's photos that you can see the ambulances backed up on the street. The police are stopping them. And the protesters themselves were trying to administer first aid, and they're trying to carry wounded people out. And the Turkish police were then on the scene, and they weren't doing anything. They weren't trying to find – they weren't helping the victims or trying to find trying to control the scene. They were beating up the protesters. They were beating up the protesters as they were carrying the victims away. Those protesters are like the enemies of the Turkish government. Those are leftists. It was a leftist labor union. Also, the Kurdish party was involved. And those are basically Kurds and leftists protesting. And Erdogan's attitude towards those people is just, you know, kill them all. They're enemies. So that when that bomb went off, the enemies of the Turkish government got killed. That's the way Turkey sees it.
And then you have another article on this topic, Russian Warplane Down, NATO's Act of War by Tony Cartolucci. And
right, right.
I think this was the first one you posted when this happened. Basically, so it's a pretty good summary, but he talks about the things, how basically Erdogan is a pan-Turkicist, and how Turkish fighters are basically a proxy force for Turkey.
Oh, sure,
and they're
used
by Turkey to fight against Assad. So, this article basically covers all the things we've been talking about. But
right,
furthermore, NATO has been supplying ISIS and Al-Qaeda, and once they get control of this strip, this area on the border of Turkey and Syria, then basically Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and the U.S. can be free to supply their jihadis in that area.
Well, they have always had control over that whole border, and that's where all the supplies for these rebels have been going in. They've been going in across the Turkish border. But the Syrian government conquered part of the border, and then over in the west, and a whole bunch of the border over in the east and towards the center was conquered by the Kurds. So 75% of the border of Syria and Turkey now is controlled by Kurds. And the Turks are just like, no way. No way are we going to allow that.
And
because
the United States
controlled-
is in an awkward situation with the Kurds, because on the one hand, the U.S. wanted a Kurdish state to have a reliable ally. But on the other hand, the U.S. is allies with Turkey, and the Turks hate the Kurds. So that puts the United States in an awkward situation.
I don't know that we've ever wanted a Kurdish state. I mean, we probably wouldn't object, but the Iraqi Kurds are federalized, and they practically have their own country up there, and we're okay with that. We probably would object to a Kurdish state because the Iraqi government is really against that, idea. Personally, I would support it, but I mean, Turkey flies into Iraqi Kurdistan, which is basically a country. They fly in there all the time and drop bombs. And Iraqi Kurdistan can't do anything about it. They can't even shoot back or anything. You know, if they even try to shoot back, Turkey's like, we're gonna raise you to the ground, you know. I mean, so they're just sitting there getting bombed by Turkey, and they can't even fight back or anything. So we're supporting the Iraqi Kurds. Now we're supporting the Syrian Kurds. We've always supported the Iranian Kurds because they're fighting a war against Iran. But we hate the Turkish Kurds, and we call them terrorists. But really, the PKK in Turkey and the YPG in Syria is the same thing. And it's all the same thing as the government in Iraq. I mean, it's all just PKK, RPG, Kurdistan government. It's all the same thing. They're all tied in with each. It's all the same entity. So we're just playing a crazy game with the Kurds. Everybody does. Everybody just manipulates them and screws them around and uses them as a tool. And the Kurds just get slaughtered, and it's all pretty disgusting.
You have this post that says, "Don't say we didn't warn you." And in 2007, NATO, and particularly the U.S., U.K., France, Germany, and Turkey, decided to overthrow the government of Bashar Assad and to defeat Iran. So you talk about this sort of importance, this... We have Iran, Syria, and Hezbollah, sort of the Shia crescent, and then you have Hamas. Hamas are actually Sunnis, but they're allied with Shias, and
they're kind of weird Sunnis, and they're not Shia haters.
They are very radical in the sense that they call for the destruction of Israel, but the thing about it is that they're not Wahhabis. They're not part of the whole sort of.
No, they're not like that at all. And actually, Islamic Jihad for quite some time was run by a guy who converted to Shiism. I mean, that was a little controversial in the Palestinian communities. And some Hamas people are saying, hey, this guy's a Shia. He's an infidel or something. What's going on? But Palestinians they don't really care about that anti-Shia thing. They're into the anti-Iran thing, but Palestinians like Hezbollah. And a lot of them like Iran. So they're not Shia haters.
I was reading something interesting. Even a lot of Christians, I was watching this video, even a lot of Christians in Lebanon, including a lot of Maronites, are supporting Hezbollah now.
You know, it used to be 80% of Lebanon supported Hezbollah, okay? I mean, that's been their traditional level of support in recent years. Supposedly, it's gone down recently, but yes, Hezbollah has the support of a large Maronite faction under Michael Aoun, and a lot of the Sunnis support Hezbollah.
What is fascinating is the bishop of the Maronite church. They're basically Catholic. He's called the Bishop of Antioch, which is actually a city in Turkey, which the Turks stole.
Right.
But he's very fascinating because he's simultaneously critical of Israel and of Islam at the same time.
Well, yeah, some Middle Eastern Christians are exactly like that. I dated this Iranian Christian woman recently, and she really hated Muslims. She hated them, and she had good reason to hate Muslims. They'd been persecuting and killing her people. She was an Assyrian Christian from Iran. They've been persecuting and killing her people for, forever now. And she didn't like them too much. But I brought up Israel, and she's a real Israel hater. At the same time, she's an Israel hater, and she's kind of an anti-Semite. Kind of a Jew hater, too. And that's pretty typical. That's pretty typical for Middle Eastern Christians. Kind of researching Jews and stuff a while back, I guess I kind of drifted off into anti-Semitism for a while, which is... I consider that an unfortunate phase of my life. But anyway, what this guy I talked to was a Syrian Christian. And he really hated Israel. And he's a real anti-Semite. He's one of the craziest anti-Semites I've ever met. And he's a Syrian Christian. And boy, did he hate Jews, man.
So you have this other post in this. You say one of the biggest lies is that Hezbollah blew up the U.S. Marine base in 83. Killing 300 U.S. Marines?
Well, it's a complicated question, okay? You know who blew up their base? Iran. Iran blew up the base. Yeah, Iran blew it up. And there was a small group called Islamic Jihad. You know, Ayman Mugnaye guy? That's like the Hezbollah's master terrorist or whatever. Well, and the Jews killed him in Damascus. Well, anyway, it was his group. It's his group that blew it up. And Islamic Jihad is just kind of this fake group that was just used by Hezbollah and Iran. And at the time that happened in 1983, Hezbollah hardly even existed. I mean, they were underground. And what's Hezbollah? What's that? And the people who did that, this Islamic Jihad group that did that, was working very, very closely with Iran and the Revolutionary Guards. And they're the ones who did that. And the Hezbollah people are pretty much out of the loop as far as that attack went. They didn't have anything to do with it. It was Iran and not Hezbollah. I don't know if that makes a big difference.
Do you think that there is an Islamic agenda to take over, basically conquer the world and invade Europe? And if so, is it primarily revolving around like Wahhabism in Saudi Arabia?
Well, yeah, the only people who want to do that are people like ISIS and Al-Qaeda. They're the only ones who explicitly want to do that. Those are the only real expansionist Muslims at the moment. But, you know, I mean, Erdogan is kind of an expansionist Muslim. And the Gulf Arabs are kind of expansionist Muslims because they're funding and supporting ISIS and Al-Qaeda. And Al-Qaeda is just, you know, they're conquering the infidels and killing the infidels, throwing them out, and just creating all Muslim countries.
Most of these really horrific mega mosques that are going up around Europe, they're being funded by Saudi Arabia and Qatar.
Sure.
But
yeah,
but the way I see it is I think it's a little bit, I don't really want, it's a little bit simplistic to make like blanket statements about all Muslims, because
yeah,
I think groups like Hezbollah and Iran, they play a role as a counterbalance to the Saudi Wahhabi agenda.
Hezbollah, Iran, and especially Hezbollah, has no interest in conquering the world and converting the world to Shia, Muslim Shiism. They're not interested in that. And they don't even persecute minorities all that much. Hezbollah treats the Christians, there are Christian towns all over Hezbollah-controlled territory, and they don't do anything to those people. There are Christian members of Hezbollah. There are Sunni members of Hezbollah. There are Druze members of Hezbollah. I mean, this thing is way more complicated than you think. And they let those Christian villages just do whatever the hell they want. You can go into Hezbollah territory and go into a bar and order a beer. You know? I mean, they are religious themselves, but they're not into opposing it on everybody. And they're not even into opposing their version of Sharia on the whole country. I mean, Nasrallah had said, well, you know, it wouldn't be too bad to have some kind of Sharia in Lebanon. But, you know, we in Hezbollah, we would never support that unless like 80% of the people were for it. Something. So, you know, they're really mellow people in a lot of ways. As far as their fellow Lebanese go, they don't persecute anybody.
You have this post, In the Belly of the Beast of the Deep State, A Look at the Council on Foreign Relations. And I know, like, the CFR, it's something you hear a lot about on, like, conspiracy theorist radio like Alex Jones. But the thing about it, I actually met Ron Paul, like, 5 years ago when he was running for office. No, it was back in 2008 I met Ron Paul. And I asked him about the CFR. And he basically said this, that they're pretty much, they're not secretive at all. They're pretty much all out in the open about what they want.
Right.
But there's basically kind of two wings of the globalist agenda that the CFR supports. There's a right wing and a left wing. So the right wing of the CFR is like Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, Thief, Wolfowitz. And then other wing is like
Kerry.
Obama, Kerry, and Clinton.
Yeah.
Also, you say Hollywood, the Silicon Valley elites, like,
The United States people are pretty united on foreign policy, aren't we? I mean, how is Hillary, the foreign policy of Obama, Hillary Clinton, Clarity, Kerry, and Ashton Carter, different from George Bush Jr., Wolfowitz,
you know what?
Pearl, Rumsfeld, and Cheney. I mean, you know, the Democratic, under a Democratic president, the U.S. foreign policy is just go around the world and do something, go into country, Ruritania, and do something crazy, stupid, and evil. And that'll be our foreign policy. That's our foreign policy in, like, most countries in the world. And the Republican response to that foreign policy is, hey, whoa, you're doing something crazy, stupid, and evil. Don't do that. That's not right. Like Google, don't be evil, you know. The Republican response to that is, let's do the same crazy, stupid, and evil thing, except 10 times harder. Drop a whole bunch more bombs, you know. I mean, that's the debate. It's a debate about how crazy we should be.
And you basically say that a liberal billionaire is no different than a conservative billionaire.
Well,
I mean,
not as much
difference
between them as people think.
George Soros is one of the most despicable evil people in the world. I mean, from a progressive perspective, he basically fits like the worst stereotype of a parasitic capitalist. He destroyed the whole economy in South Asia. But he's also playing a major role. He's very anti-Russian, and he's playing a major role. And his open society is playing a major role in helping these migrants get into Europe.
Yeah, the open society is doing all sorts of other weird stuff. Yeah, they are bringing in all those migrants. And yes, he does hate Russia. He's a Russia hater. He's from Hungary, and he's a Jew. He's a Hungarian Jew. As you said, he's a parasitic capitalist. He's a classic anti-Semitic stereotype of the grasping Jew. Actually, the grasping revolutionary Jew, because he's trying to push all this SJW stuff on rather conservative white nations. But anyway, he left there after the communists took over. I guess he survived the Nazis. Okay, I'll give him that. Okay, I'm glad you survived enough, George Soros. Thanks. Good job. I guess some of his relatives died. But anyway, then he was grown up in Hungary, and then they left there in 56 or something like that during the revolution, and they moved up to the West. And so he's a commie hater. He's a communist hater, and he's a Russia hater. He's a USSR hater. He's a Russia hater from Eastern Europe. Okay, I mean,
exactly.
That's all he is.
So with the CFR, they basically represent the interests of like large multinational corporations, especially like finance and oil.
Yes.
But you know what? Earlier in the show, you were saying that you think Donald Trump is a fascist. But you know what?
Yes.
I mean, you have some valid criticisms, but if I'm forced to choose, I would take Donald Trump than any of those, like, CFR-appointed candidates. If I'm forced to choose.
He is sort of a fascist, but you know what? He's kind of a Peronist. He's kind of a Peronist.
You are probably going to kind of hate me for this, but I'm seriously considering voting for him because I look at the alternatives. I mean, I don't want another Bush or Clinton. I like a lot of aspects of Bernie Sanders, but I can't vote for him because he's for amnesty. So basically, I'm probably going to vote for Trump anyway, if that's basically what we have to choose from.
Trump on economics and on populist stuff and for regular work-class people and middle-class people, he's running as a populist. And he's for the workers and for the middle class. He's kind of against the rich. The guy, Trump is practically running as a socialist, you know. And I appreciate that. I appreciate him for that. But he's also got this right-wing populist thing going on. So he's like a Peronist. He's a Peronist. Okay. Peron also had his goon squad running around beating up his enemies. And I guess he was anti-commie and stuff. But normally fascists, they're not that cool towards the workers, really. I mean, they claim Hitler, not Nazis were, but I'm kind of dubious
basically
of that.
Basically with this, I think you have some valid points, but I'm probably going to vote for him. I'll just close things up. I'm going to vote for him based on what the alternative is, and I'll leave it at that.
Well, I'm not completely opposed to Peronis.
No, I mean, I actually did a show about Juan Perón with Kerry Bolton a while back. I'd recommend checking that out.
Yeah, well, how did
Perón
feel about Perón?
He's very pro-Perón, but Perón was actually opposed by both the communists and the ultra-wealthy at the same time.
Sure, yeah, well, right. Yeah, that would make sense.
You have this post, so-called on the cultural left, and he's a professor and author, but he says that he's like an old leftist, and he says basically, I confess that I'm an unabashed old leftist who was never quite understood how deconstruction was supposed to help the working class. Am I a stodgy old scientist who believes naively that there exists an external world, that there exists objective truths about that world, and that my job is to discover some of them?
Right, yeah, I believe he's actually a physicist. It's kind of weird, left-wing physicist, although Einstein was one. Most people don't know that. Einstein was a socialist. Right, because the deconstructionists say that, I guess they say there is no external world, and they also say that there aren't objective truths anymore. Everything's just an opinion, I guess. They don't even like science. They call it scientism. And they think it's an oppressive structure that tries to say that there's certain facts about the world and that oppresses, you know, these oppressed groups or whatever. Deconstruction is just kind of a ridiculous form of postmodernism. Derrida and people like that, Lacan and those people, it's basically a bunch of unreadable philosophers writing text that makes no sense, and that's deconstructionism.
So you commented on some of the shows that I did, and you said most of them are pretty much in line with your views from the alt-left. Mm-hmm. Oh, you just said you disagreed with one of the comments that Matt Forney said about the middle class being driven out of cities by him blaming the left on it?
Yeah, that book is really wrong. He shouldn't even... I'm sorry he's even quoting that book.
I brought it up.
Oh, I hate that book. That book, he's wrong.
You've read it?
Michael Jones. I read about it. And I don't like E. Michael Jones. Tradcon. I'm not a conservative.
He's socially conservative, but he's anti-capitalist.
Is he? Oh, well, he's too
yeah.
much of a tradcon for me. He's a traditional Catholic, and I'm just not down with that. And his conspiracy theory about how the left destroyed the cities, I just don't believe it.
He doesn't, he doesn't blame the left per se. His theory actually... That's not at all what he's saying. What E. Michael Jones said is you had these working class, like Irish, Italian, and Polish Catholic communities who were supporting the labor unions, and then the WASP elite who were opposed to the labor unions, they did forced integration with busing blacks, but they also did urban renewal projects by tearing down their communities as a way to weaken their political power. So the book isn't anti-leftist at all. I think you're misconstruing his ideas.
Yeah, well, okay. I guess we'll just agree to disagree on that. Because the urban renewal was just turn down slum. It wasn't turn down those Irish and Italian communities. There was busing going on, but there were no intentions about getting rid of these WOPs and MITs or whatever they are.
Busing did is it totally destroyed the urban school system, so then all those people ended up moving out to the suburbs.
Yeah, well, that was not intentional. The left-wingers that did that, the liberals did that, That was, they didn't intend that to happen. You know, E. Michael Jones acts like that was done intentionally to drive all those white people out of the cities or something, so they could bring in a bunch of minorities to vote Democrat. I don't really know. He doesn't make sense. I don't believe it. And we didn't tear down Little Italy for urban renewal projects. We tore down slums.
Did you check out that interview with Charles Lincoln about cities, that one?
I only listened to a little bit of it. He's good, though. Very smart.
What do you think about his premise, his whole premise, like about that a single-family home is the ideal for living and that density is bad? Do you think it's more a reactionary theory?
I don't agree with that at all. And the experience of Europe has shown that you can pack people into cities and it's not a problem. I mean, European white people can apparently live pretty much packed in and it's no big deal. I mean, you go to an Italian city down in Sicily or something, and boy, they sure packed in there. The roads are so narrow, you wonder how a car even goes up and down them. And that's experience in Europe. That's experience in Europe.
So you see it more as a sort of American concept that everyone has to own a single-family home?
It's an American conceit, I would say.
What is your thoughts on this whole sort of movement to increase density within the urban cores of cities as an alternative to building more, spread more single-family home in the suburbs? I guess you could call it like new urbanism. We're building denser in the urban core near like mass transit. Do you support that?
Yeah, sure. And you know Kunstler, James Kunstler.
Yeah, I know him.
He says this whole idea of the suburbs, it's gone. It's history. It's going to go out, and we're all going to be living packed in cities or out in the rural areas or whatever. Because the whole idea of these suburbs was based on cheap oil. And these suburbs, they are dying. With the housing crisis, they're just drying up. A lot of those suburbs are practically abandoned now. The white people kept moving further and further out from the cities, trying to get away from the blacks and the browns, mostly the blacks. And the suburbs just kept getting further and further and further away. And there were people who were driving like 2 hours each way and just completely insane things like that, you know, just so they could live around a bunch of white people and not have to live around a bunch of NAMs, whatever they are.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's not sustainable. That's not sustainable to have these crazy faraway suburbs and people driving 100 miles a day just into work in the city and then driving back 100 miles way out to their white suburb. That's not sustainable. It's not sustainable in the long term. It's not going to work. And Kunstler's right. Kunstler's right. Those suburbs are doomed. Correct. I've lived in cities before. I lived in L.A. I lived in Fresno. I live in a small city now. Not sure if I want to live in a big city again. I don't know. Big cities are fun when you're young, but I'm not so young anymore, so I'm not sure how fun it would be.
So, Robert Lindsay, it's been an excellent show. We covered a lot of really interesting topics.
Yeah, sure. It was a pleasure to be on.
Thanks for being on. That's all we have for today's show. So take care, and we'll be back with you next time.
Thank you.